Do you ever feel stuck, like you're living your life on autopilot? Are you ready to shift into high gear and reach the success you so richly deserve? Welcome to the Play Big Movement podcast. I am your host, Sharon Lecter, entrepreneur, business strategist, and best-selling author. Playing big is not about settling for good enough or being comfortable. It is about reaching your highest potential and achieving your greatest success. Join me in my Play Big movement as I interview top experts in business, money, and entrepreneurship, all ready to serve you and to help you play big, be number one in your field, live your legacy, and create maximum impact. Hi, everybody. Welcome to this segment of the Play Big Movement podcast with Sharon Lecter. And today I have someone that I just think the world of. We've known each other, gosh, Lauren, maybe 5-6 years. Yeah. And we share a passion for women in business. Lauren Flanagan she's just an incredible woman out there supporting so many of us. Not only did she start and exit 4 tech companies, but she identified a gap in the market, a need for women investing in women, and obviously women needing more capital and more investment dollars. So she went on to found 2 companies, not just one Phenomenal Capital, one Bell Capital, and continues to mentor. She's on many boards. She's an incredible gift to the women that work with her. So Lauren, thank you and welcome to the Play Big Movement podcast.
Thank you, Sharon, for having me. It's always delightful to be able to share some time with you and talk about things that matter.
Well, and it does. It really does matter. And we've had the opportunity to be together on many occasions, but always there to support one another. And I love your mantra, women are the solution to our capital access problems. And so you really looked at 2 different issues. One was women needing access to capital, but you also serve the need for all the women out there who have been successful, who are looking on how to support other women. So you're actually solving both pieces. So I know you grew up in the Bay Area. So talk a little bit about Little Lauren and then that move to the Michigan, to the heartland of America, and the decision to go into this world.
Okay, great. Thank you. So I grew up in the Bay Area, California, and my original dream as a young person was to be a sportscaster. I thought nothing could be more fun than getting paid to go to every game.
I did not know that about you.
That I could give my opinions because, as my father likes to say, you give your opinions whether anybody wants to hear them or not, so you could get paid for them. That'd be really good. So, that was my real dream. But at that time, you know, women couldn't even go in the locker room or any of that. So I didn't think that was a viable option. And I ended up, you know, becoming an entrepreneur at a very young age, really having businesses even in high school and college and putting together my first computer. I soldered it and did it from a kit and, you know, got into that early computer world and, you know, started software companies and exited all of them. And, you know, I spent 20 some years doing that as a CEO, working like crazy. I had bootstrapped all except my last company, and I had to go raise a lot of money. In those days, to try to build a big data center like you can get for $1,000 a month at AWS or Google, you know, we spent, you know, many millions of dollars to do it. I raised about $23 million, and it was a terrible process. I mean, here I am, this very competent, confident person. I'm never afraid of, you know, talking with a room full of men. I was used to that in the tech industry. But you're sitting in a meeting with all these VCs and they'd be talking to all my male colleagues, not me. And I'm the CEO. And, you know, they were just not listening to me and discounting the company or looking and, well, are we going to have to replace her? And I realized that how hard it was. I like to say it's like weightlifting on Venus. You know, there's more gravity, so everything is heavier. So I just said, this is really broken and, you know, it needs fixing someday. At that point, I was really focused on my company. And then the VCs that I had, one of them was just awful. I mean, horrific. And when we would go, you know, at it with one another about some issue, They would always say, well, you know the golden rule, Lauren, then with the gold makes the rules. So basically shut up and do it or go. And I remember thinking at that time as well, if I ever become an investor, I'm going to practice the real golden rule, which is treat people the way you would like to be treated. And so those things were germinating in me, even in my last venture, because before that I had bootstrapped my companies, and it's something I advise companies today. It's like, you know, it's not how much you raise, it's how much you keep. And so many companies just chase the big dollars without saying, couldn't I get revenues first? Or can't I get some other funding partners to help me so I don't have to raise so much? And, you know, I was able to do that in my early days by finding customers who would prepay or pay against milestones, and hiring team members who I would compensate in the same way, would pay them some in advance, some for hitting the milestones, and negotiate bonuses if we were ahead or penalties if we were behind, and I passed the same along. So I had a loyal team of developers that would work for me on these projects. And, you know, you were profitable from day one if you were smart about your budgeting and how to do it. So it was only when I got into the capital that I discovered this other world, which frankly isn't right for every company. But these guys were just horrific. I mean, really, really bad. I'll not name them to protect the guilty. But, you know, it was galvanizing for me. And so after I sold my last company, my mother had been born in Michigan, and I was helping her out. And she wanted to go back to Michigan for her last chapter. So I moved her out, and we bought some property in a small house, thinking, you know, it's a place to visit when we see her. Well, one thing led to another. I started advising companies and started actually four funds now, and you know, started actively investing. I've invested in more than 40 companies. But it was really looking at this problem that women had a difficulty getting access to capital. It's much harder for women. You know, we don't like to talk about it too much, but the truth is there's all this both conscious and subconscious bias. The questions that are asked by of women and entrepreneurs are different than of male entrepreneurs. And women talk about their success differently. I mean, one of the classic things is a male entrepreneur says, oh, I did this, this, and this at my last company. And maybe he was on a team that did it and might himself have done nothing. A woman might have actually did it will say, well, I was on a team that we did, blah, 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 even if she was the prime mover. And so VCs will say that, well, the woman's not confident, but she's just being more modest in ascribing the benefits of the team.
It is so, so true. A lot of, you know, I often say men have no problem saying they're an expert. Women will say, well, I'm pretty good at it.
Right. So that's classic. And it feeds the whole problem of, you know, it's first a pattern recognition. Most of the investors are men, and so they're more comfortable with people like them. And second, they want them to communicate in the way they communicate. So you can break through and learn some of these things, but it's still a difficult problem for both the women and, you know, for the investors who I don't think set out to be bad. They don't think about it, or they're just not aware of all of their biases. And then we're in the middle of the biggest transfer of wealth in history. Women are about to get many trillions, $30 trillion over the next 20 years. We already have the majority of wealth in this country. More than 51% in virtually every state, and more in some states, but we're more conservative how we invest. You know, almost everybody's got something called alternatives in their portfolio, and most people don't know what that is. You know, I don't even know what my alternatives are. They're not doing very well. And so I always say, well, you could be thinking of part of your alternatives to be investing in early stage tech companies that are led by women. Probably not going to do any worse than you're doing today. And you will at least be helping a category that needs it. And you can get involved, be hands-on if you want, and learn about that process, which is, you know, a great opportunity. If we can educate more women on how to do the investing, we have the money. And if we pool it, we can change the entire ecosystem for women and other underrepresented categories, minorities, immigrant entrepreneurs, people in, you know, states that aren't on the coasts, veterans, disabled persons. So there's lots of categories that aren't getting the funding, but have a better track record actually on performing. So I looked at this two-sided problem. I mean, I read your Find Your Passion, and, you know, my passion is fixing this and both helping the entrepreneurs and investing in them, and then helping women find the way to do that as well and learn how to invest. And I just taught my first man how to do early stage investing, which was very fun.
Good for you. That's great.
We need our male allies too. I mean, we need the male allies.
Yes, we do. I say, you know, we have to, instead of criticizing, there's a long way for us to still go, but we've come a long way. So let's celebrate the men that have been helpful and ignore the ones that haven't been. So,
amen. I have so many great men that have helped me along the way. I learned investing, mentored my first fund by a lawyer from Foley, Joe Hildebrandt, who said, Lauren, you got to come do this with us. And I didn't know anything about it, you know, and he had run their venture group. And he taught me the game, and he's fantastic. I love him to death. And he really helped me learn how to do the other side of the problem. I knew how to help entrepreneurs, but I really didn't know how to do the investing and teach women. So I'm forever grateful to Joe Hildebrandt.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's obviously one of the keys in Think and Grow Rich for Women in the book is for us to acknowledge and celebrate the good guys instead of spending a lot of negativity on the ones that have been in our way. So it's important. So one of the things I want to talk about today, and of course we didn't talk about this ahead of time, but I'm pretty sure I know that you're pretty solid on this. When somebody wants monies and they, you know, one of your first pieces of advice is you research the firms before you go to them, right? Because you have particular niches that you operate in. Talk a little bit about to those women out there that are looking for financing. What's a few good first steps for them?
Yeah, so first you have to know what kind of financing you need and what stage you're at. But let's assume we're talking about a venture capital type model. Most investors have stages that they invest in that they'll only do seed or early stage or later stage. They often have geographic or industry requirements. So you really need to know those investors. It's so much wasted time if you just go shotgun as opposed to rifle shot. I know you like to shoot, so we'll use those metaphors. I like to shoot too. It's fun. So for target practice, right? you want to have a clear list of targets and why would they want to talk with you? And then the best thing besides researching them is looking at their portfolio companies. Are there any companies in there with which you would have synergies? Because the warmest, best intro you could ever get is talking to one of their companies who thinks you have a good product or service and asking them to introduce you to their investor. After, of course, you've asked how it was to work with them. Because that's another failing women do is they tend not, they're like, oh, I'm so glad somebody's giving me money. They don't like check them out. And these are bad dudes, some of them. And so just like dating, you know, you want to know who that person is and get to know them for a while, because once they're in your company, you're married. You're married until there's an exit. So it's very important to do an equal amount of diligence. So that's probably the number one mistake that most entrepreneurs, but particularly women, make is not doing their homework on who's the right person, how can I best get in touch with them, and are they really going to be a fit for me, instead of just, oh, please give me the money. You can be careful what you wish for, right?
Oh, absolutely. And you also said something earlier that I want to highlight, because this is something when Mike and I work with companies, you know, it's like, know how much money you need to get to the next level, but allow your valuation to increase. So many people go out and get a bunch of money and give up most of their company before the value's there. And so if you can design it so that you're in tranches, and then, as you said, I think milestones, then you have the best opportunity to maintain and keep the most of your company. So speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, the really key there for what you're saying is really understanding the total amount of capital it's going to take for you to either achieve your exit or to get to cash flow break even, whichever you think will happen first. And then you've got to work backwards. So, you know, if you think you're going to need a round for development and a round for sales and marketing and a round for expansion, then how much are each of those? And then work backward to your first round so you can begin to say, all right, well, I think I'm going to be at, you know, 50 million in sales in 7 years, and the multiples in, you know, my market are 4x. So I think it's maybe a $200 million exit. And you can kind of work backwards to that first couple million you raise to see what's a reasonable valuation. But that's where people get lost, is they're not looking like, how could I invest this money that's going to be a driver for higher valuation and the next round because I've achieved a major milestone. You know, product fit in the market is a key first one. Expanding the team, getting a repeatable sales cycle is an important second one that you know, okay, I've got the product market fit. I've got a sales cycle that I can repeat. So now if I throw money behind this, I know this can really scale. And do I have the team that I've needed to be able to scale it? So those are usually the major inflection points for growth, but they may be different depending on the product or service. So you need to know what it is for your company or in your type of industry, and then how much are the typical amounts raised for those. So it takes a lot of research to do this. It's not simple, and there are organizations and books and services out there to help. It is a complex problem, but number one, you can't be too prepared.
That's true. That's true. I said, you know, you can start off with a whole lot of information so that it's there, but then tailor it down so you've got that that elevator pitch, but you need to be able to answer the questions. So talk about the dog and pony show for me a little bit, because that's evolved over time as well, hasn't it?
Right. So you've got to absolutely have your elevator pitch, which is, you know, as long as it would take in an elevator to talk about the problem, the solution, and why you and your team are the ones to make it happen. And you also need to have really carefully honed your asks, depending on who it is you're with. Because if you meet somebody for coffee or whatever, you want to be able to have an ask. But I think a really important thing before the dog and pony is having developed the relationship. So if you've done your homework, you've gotten an intro, you've maybe sent them articles of interest or things that you think might be relevant to them, told them how you're doing progress-wise, and then, you know, let them track you a little bit so that when you're finally ready to ask for money, they feel like they know something about you. That is the most successful strategy. And it's more important than, you know, the perfect pitch deck. People spend a ton of time on the pitch deck. When I went out and raised my money for, I didn't even do a pitch deck. I wrote with magic marker on the whiteboard because these guys will go to sleep. You know, the lights are down. They're looking at their phones. And I'm like, nobody's paying attention. I'm like, flip the lights on. I got up and started. And they're like, they were like waking up and looking because somebody's in the front of the room walking around and I'm drawing pictures. And guess what? That made me look like an expert too, because I didn't have to have somebody's prepared PowerPoint. So it's really about the story that you tell. You know, how compelling is it that are you solving a must-have problem? And, you know, can you tell a great story around it? And do you have your metrics? I mean, those are the things that are going to grab any investor. What are the metrics for your product market fit, you know, size of the market? You know, what are your metrics in terms of sales traction and repeatability? If you have those metrics and a compelling solution for a must-have need, then most investors are going to be interested in that. But the other key piece is to really understand investors want to know how they're going to make money. For them, the company is the product, not the product. And that was the biggest mistake I made when I was talking about my product.
Oh, repeat that.
So, you know, I was really good at sales, so I was always selling my product. But to an investor, the company is the product, not the product.
That's so good.
They want to know how they make money out of the company. So that was my epiphany. The company's the product. Okay, so now talk about your company like it's your product. And that's what's going to really cut through to
investors. That's brilliant. That's brilliant. So speak to the importance or your feelings related to intellectual property owned by the company.
Yeah, well, the patent laws are changing, but it's very important to protect your intellectual property in all the ways you can. And in software companies, you don't usually do a patent. I mean, sometimes you will, but you still want to protect it with good lawyers so that you have the right kind of confidentiality agreements, the right kind of employment agreements, that when you do partnering, you've got your NDAs and, you know, whatever other things you need to have in there so that you can protect it. You know, some businesses are open source. That's different, where they're building on a community of open source. So it really depends on the type of company. Clearly, when you're in like life sciences and the medical field, usually there's a lot of patents. In manufacturing, there's typically both design and utility patents. But there's always trade secrets. I think that's the most important thing, is contractually to protect your trade secrets and to develop this intellectual property, because it can have a value much greater than the revenue that your business is generating if it's truly strategic. And so, for example, you know, let's say in a medical one, you'll have your primary patent, and then you'll go out as a strategy and get picket fence patents. So you surround that category that has got a lot of flags in the turf. And to an acquirer, that's going to make it much more attractive that this work has been done. And they know that if they put billions of dollars into it, that it's got some protection. So it's very important in certain industries. It's less important in others, but always your trade secrets are important. And often a patent can have another life, or intellectual property can have another life beyond your business. Like, you might be able to license that, some application that your company isn't going to pursue, and that would be in a non-conflicting or non-competitive way to another industry.
That gives you another revenue source, right?
It could be another revenue
licensing
source.
Is a huge, huge opportunity, particularly in today's world.
Out-licensing. One of my portfolio companies, I just love them. They're fantastic. It's called Vital Bio, and they've got disinfecting lights. And so they can license to all kinds of partners, whether it goes in airplanes or hospitals or ambulances or sports stadiums. So many, many people who can take their technology and productize it. You can today buy it in Amazon and Lowe's for under your cabinet lights to completely kill any pathogen on any surface under your
cabinet. Wonderful. What was the name again?
Vital Bio, VitalVio. And they also have bathroom lights to kill the mold and stuff in your bathroom. So
you can. Cool. Yeah. I'm gonna go shopping when we're done.
Yeah, so that's an example where they have a lot of patents and they're getting more. And those patents are the secret to licensing to multiple distribution partners, generating multiple streams of revenue. So ultimately, they're going to have a big exit. We're excited. We were in early and wonderful young CEO. I mean, this is the kind of story I love, right? She was the co-founder, and originally the investors had brought in a gray-haired guy to run it. Who was good. He was good to start, but he wasn't increasingly the right fit. And a few years ago, I was back with her at a meeting in California, and I'm like, Colleen, you're the founder. You sell this. You know this product. You should step up as CEO. And she was afraid. She was a little bit lacking confidence. I'm like, you can do it. My business partner in Bell is her chairman. I said, you can get some strong COO, CFO, and everyone around you. You can do it. And so, in fact, we surrounded her with a great team, and she has just taken off like lightning. She's amazing. And she was a Kairos, 30 under 30. And she's this extraordinary person. But there's so many of these young, talented women that if you just give them money and help, she truly is making the world safer for people. And it's a really important type of business. So that's my magic. And then another one is another company I invested in. The two executives there, the two women there, they then invested in, that was from Phenomenal. And then they became limited partners in Bell Capital. So that's really my model, help make them successful and then help them reinvest in other women. And that's my play big movement.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And you do. I mean, you also provide a tremendous amount of counsel and mentorship. And so before we get to the end of this, which is coming up, I just want to make sure if people are interested in more about Lauren Flanagan, how can they reach out to you?
Well, they can reach me at Lauren, L-A-U-R-E-N, at Bell, B-E-L-L-E, VC.com, VC like venture capital. That's probably the easiest. Or if they want help with how to think about these things, they can contact me at Lauren at BiteSizeSolutions.com. That's speed coaching for founders. Or they can go to Springboard, which I'm on the board, which is the premier network for women-led tech companies. And they can contact me either there. I'm Lauren at sb.co. So I've got a lot of emails, but anyway, you could always start with Bell. That's the easy one, and I can forward it. But I do help a lot of companies, both mentoring at Springboard and clients at BiteSize and my other strategic, or in investing in Bell. So not everybody fits the Bell. We have a pretty narrow sweet spot.
Yeah, but I love your intake process at Bell. Describe that a little bit, because on your website, you really walk people through it.
Yeah, it's actually based on one of these companies that I invested in, the one I mentioned where the founders became investors. It's a web telephony technology from Harkin. So you go into the pitch me at bellvc.com, and it'll ask you some questions, and then you'll get an auto phone call, and there'll be some more audio questions or video. And that's how we're able to share anything we're interested in with a team of people to look at it without making you have to do it over and over. So it's pretty cool tech, and it makes it, I think, easy for the entrepreneur and very easy for a distributed team of investors to review and consider.
Well, thank you so much, Lauren. And thank you guys for watching today. I hope you'll rewind and re-listen, because that the last 23 minutes has been nothing but a wealth of information from someone who has been there, done that multiple times. So Lauren, you're going to stay with me for a few more minutes, because we're going to do a section for the private Facebook group. But thank you so much, Lauren. I really appreciate you as a friend, as a mentor, as a fellow woman invested in making sure other women achieve the success they deserve. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Sharon. And thank you for the Play Big movement, because it's play big or go home. You know, it's all about how do we make these big leveraged moves that make your life better and make the world better.
Absolutely. Couldn't have said that better myself. Thank you. And thank you all for being with us today on the Play Big Movement with Sharon Lecter. Now stay tuned and join us in the Facebook group to hear more from Lauren. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this segment of the Play Big Movement podcast. Please subscribe to iTunes and leave us a review, as well as join us in other areas of social media, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn at Sharon Lecter, and for Facebook, author Sharon Lecter. Thank you so much, and have a fabulous day.